among the separatists, who point to the increasing support for their case among EU lawmakers.
The number of MEPs that feel uncomfortable with the current course of events with the Spanish government has almost tripled. And this is huge and speaks tons, speaks thousands of, on one hand, how the Spanish government is handling the situation, on how the European Commission is not handling the situation.
The European vote revealed deep divisions within the coalition government in Madrid after junior partner Podemos decided to vote against lifting the immunity for Puigdemont, Comín and Ponsatí. Puigdemont's lieutenant in Catalonia Monday noted that the strategy of the separatists to take the conflict to the world stage is beginning to bear fruit.
The internationalization of the repression of Catalan elected officials by the Spanish state is more relevant than ever before in the heart of Europe. We will see what precedent this case sets in EU courts and parliament.
As Spain mulls issuing new arrest warrants for the three Catalan MEPs, their defense team have vowed to take the case to the European justice.
All eyes are now on the European Court of Justice, where the next legal battle will play out, much to the discomfort of EU member states, which seem increasingly embroiled in the Catalan case for independence. Cassai Kadri, Barcelona.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeida and LBB have stopped their operations and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country.
International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran and the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden remain in a standoff over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The U.S. says Iran must take the first step and return to full compliance with the deal, but Tehran says Washington must do so because former President Donald Trump unilaterally walked away from the accord in May 2018 and reimpose sanctions.
Since the U.S. backed out of the deal, it should take the first step. The one that broke the deal must return to it sooner and knows that Iran is ready to fulfill its commitments.
Iran, which began scaling down its JCPOA commitments 1 year after Washington's withdrawal, says its measures are in line with two paragraphs of the accord and in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their obligations. On Wednesday, top Iranian security sources ruled out a step-by-step return to the deal, reiterating that Tehran will hold talks with the U.S. only if it lifts its unilateral sanctions. Speaking to Press TV, they also stressed that Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the U.S. removes its sanctions. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader during a speech last month. Ayatollah Khamenei also said during his February speech that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure over its nuclear program and could enrich uranium up to 60% purity if the country needed it. He, however, reiterated that the Islamic Republic will never seek nukes. Now, as Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse the course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
The coronavirus pandemic in Iran is now past its third peak, but a new wave of the virus is feared to be gripping the country, with some southern areas witnessing a surge in infections and fatalities. That has left hospitals, especially in the southwestern province of Khuzestan, short of beds. Now, to make up for the bed shortage in the worst affected areas, the headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, which is an entity affiliated with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, has launched Mobile Hospital, which is fully equipped and ready to be deployed to the target zones.
The Mobile Hospital has all the necessary equipment to serve as a super specialty hospital in the less privileged areas and the hardest hit zones during the pandemic. The 500-bed hospital is connected to a telemedicine network and can use the facilities of other hospitals if necessary.
The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order has been at the forefront of efforts to fight the pandemic in Iran. Its main focus has been on developing a domestic COVID vaccine. The jab, called Coviran, is now at its second human trial stage. Three other Iranian entities are also developing their own vaccines.
We have reached the capability to produce COVID vaccines based on all the platforms that are existing today, such as mRNA, vector, attenuated virus, recombinant proteins, etc. We are facing the US sanctions that prevent other countries from selling us their vaccines, so we have had to rely on our own resources. The process is a bit lengthy, but we hope to be able to get a local vaccine to the market in a matter of 5 months.
Nearly 1.7 million people in Iran have so far caught the virus. Over 60,000 of them have succumbed to the disease. As Iranian vaccines are yet to make their way to the market, authorities are importing foreign-made jabs, such as Russia's Sputnik V, to inoculate people. So far, Moscow has dispatched three vaccine consignments, topping 320,000 doses. Iran has also imported another 250,000 vaccine doses from China. Experts say the pandemic is outpacing the vaccination program, and for now, early diagnosis and medication is still the only way to contain the virus. The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order says it's also speeding up efforts to get its vaccine to the mass production stage as soon as possible. But it says developing the infrastructure for COVID patients is still a high priority, since the fight against the coronavirus is still far from over. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Heartbreaking scenes are appearing from Jammu region of Indian administered Kashmir after authorities launched a drive against illegal immigrants in the region. Authorities are going makeshift to makeshift, collecting biometrics and other details of Rohingya refugees. The drive is a part of an exercise to trace foreigners living without valid documents. According to official records, so far 168 immigrant Rohingyas have been detained due to lack of documentation.
They have taken my husband and now they are not allowing us to see each other. I don't know why we are unwanted everywhere. We've been facing worse times back home and now here also. Why is the world silent on our plight? Is it because we are Muslims or because of our race or our color?
Calling it a conspiracy to alter the demographic character of Hindu-dominated Jammu region, the political parties and social organizations there have urged the government of India to immediately deport the Muslim Rohingya refugees and other nationals.
On the basis of humanitarian grounds, we have given space to these refugees, but now the numbers are soaring and it's a matter of concern. It will have impact on our safety and security. The aim of BJP government is to deport them back to Myanmar.
Fearing detention, now many families are leaving the refugee camps and moving to unknown destinations.
We have lifelong seen separation. We separated when we left our homes in Myanmar. And for a while we were together again at refugee camps in Bangladesh. There also we were forced to run for life. We came to India and now we are again on the same path of running for our lives. We don't want to witness separation. Let us live or kill us, but do not separate us from our loved ones.
According to official records, 13,700 foreigners, including Rohingya Muslims and Bangladeshi nationals, are settled in the Jammu region, where their population has almost doubled between 2006 and 2016. According to the United Nations, Rohingyas, an ethnic Muslim minority group, is the world's most persecuted minority. The community has faced institutionalized discrimination, such as denial of citizenship in Myanmar, predominantly Buddhist country, and is denied movement, state education, and civil service jobs.
Thousands of Rohingya refugees have fled their homes after facing exodus at the hands of Buddhist authorities. But till day, the world has failed to secure the future of this community, who are now living in a constant fear of deportation in the scattered parts of the world, like Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Bangladesh, and India. Shahana Bhatt from the Jammu region of Indian administered Kashmir.
How the EU deals with crises was the subject of scathing criticism during a debate on the bloc's health systems in the European Parliament. There were major failings when COVID-19 began to wreak havoc in Italy 13 months ago, and now the EU's vaccine strategy is being described as a fiasco.
Ci sta chiedendo perché.
Citizens are wondering why we are not rolling out the Chinese, Russian or Cuban vaccines. Perhaps it's because the European Union has decided to give more importance to relations with the US instead of saving thousands of people.
The death toll from COVID-19 in the 27-country EU is approaching 550,000.
The pandemic exposed the vulnerability of our healthcare systems as we experienced care disruptions, medical shortages, health system inadequacy, insufficient and unequal access to healthcare.
Instead of improving during the course of the pandemic, apparently the situation is getting worse.
Some of these inequalities are widening, not only across countries, but also across population groups within each country.
One clear example of inequality was highlighted during the debate. Statistics show a person in intensive care with COVID-19 in Luxembourg has a 65% chance of survival. In fellow EU nation Romania, it's just 25%.
Some legislators say the EU's poor handling of successive crises has dangerous political consequences, and experts agree.
We're seeing the rise of the far right across Europe, and this is not just far right, not right, just right-wing populism. This is naked racism. This is neo-fascism.
The EU Commissioner for Health, Stella Kariakides, has told lawmakers that lessons have been learned the hard way due to the coronavirus.
Indeed, we're determined to respond in a way that looks to the future and develops concrete benefits and protection to the citizens.
Legislators have just passed a €5.1 billion budget for a programme called EU for Health. However, they are well aware that reforms don't happen overnight when it comes to the EU project. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma, and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeidah and LBB have stopped their operations and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country.
International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A cry for help for France's more than 3 million Muslims. A letter of complaint signed by a global coalition of 25 civil society organizations and NGOs spanning 11 countries to the President of the European Commission, urging immediate action against France for what they call is its state-sponsored Islamophobia. Renamed the Charter of Principles, the Imam Charter's 10 articles set out the so-called Republican values to which all imams in France should subscribe. Either you're with the Republic, the French president has warned, or you're not with the Republic.
What Macron is trying to do is feed into a narrative that Muslims is a cultural threat to France. And really, the reality is that France, the vast majority of French Muslims are law-abiding citizens. They've been arising social, economically in French society, and that is a concern and a threat to the French elite.
The new letter of complaint follows a similar one in January by a coalition of Muslim NGOs to the UN Human Rights Council. The already existing problem of French Islamophobia took a turn for the worse in the wake of the beheading of schoolteacher Samuel Paty by a Takfiri extremist outside his school in November last year for showing offensive cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad during his class. For the French president, that provided a valuable opportunity. He defended the profane cartoons and introduced legislation targeting so-called Islamic extremism.
So this is entirely cynical. He's using this for political gain. And the reality is, as soon as you start conceding room to the far right, then that normalizes them. So I wouldn't be surprised if he actually loses votes.
The deeply offensive caricatures set off angry protests worldwide. But inside France, a crackdown on the Muslim community. Multiple mosques were forced to close. The country's biggest Muslim charity and an anti-Islamophobia organization were banned. Dozens of people were arrested, and hundreds faced deportation. Critics say the recent moves by the French state target Muslims and alienates them. And the French government's attempt at aligning French Islam with Republican values and to combat separatism raises more questions than answers. Saeed Kouraza, London.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, sir.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust. From the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps. From the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Hello everyone, a warm welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while backing those who violate them. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized Washington and the UN for being quick to condemn the Yemenis for their retaliatory attacks rather than trying to stop the Saudi massacre of Yemeni women and children. He also argued that Washington created a military base in Syria without the permission of Damascus. He called for the withdrawal of American forces from both Syria and Iraq. The leader also blamed Washington for having the world's largest nuclear arsenal. He reminded the fact that the U.S. is the only country that has used nukes while claiming to oppose weapons of mass destruction.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has denounced the policies of the United States. In his speech marking the occasion of Eid al-Mab'ath, Ayatollah Khamenei slammed Washington for building military bases in the region under the pretext of fighting terrorism and called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei said Washington is the only country that has used nuclear weapons in action, but it claims to be against weapons of mass destruction. He noted that Washington still has the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world. Iran's leader also accused Washington of turning a blind eye as its Arab allies keep bombarding civilians in Yemen. He pointed out that Washington and even the United Nations, however, raised an outcry as soon as the people of Yemen started defending themselves against the Saudi-led aggressors. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while supporting those who violate them. Washington's double standards were also highlighted in remarks made by Iran's foreign minister. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said the new U.S. administration is still sticking to a policy of maximum pressure against Iran but claims to favor diplomacy. Zarif also denounced Washington's move to block the release of Iranian assets frozen in South Korea. He noted that Iran needs the fund to purchase food and medicine as the country is fighting to contain the spread of the new coronavirus. Iran's foreign minister made the comments after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced Washington's opposition to unfreezing of the Iranian funds by South Korea. Blinken said the money will only be released when Iran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran, however, says it will only reverse its commitment cuts once Washington removes all its unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Iranian officials argue it was the U.S. that threw the agreement into crisis by its withdrawal and must therefore be the one who returns to it first. On the surface, it looks like the new administration in the White House has chosen to adopt less hawkish policies and engage more with the world. But in reality, little has changed since Joe Biden took the helm in January. Eyes are now on the Biden administration to see whether Washington will choose to give up its bullying or keep on the same beaten track.
All right, that was a report by Matthew Fireman. Let me invite our guests to this debate show. We have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier out of Brussels, an author and researcher Daniel Jegic from Beirut. Gentlemen, good to have you both on the show. Now, let's go to Brussels. Elijah, Iran's leader criticized the United States for its hypocritical foreign policies and also distortion of facts for its own benefit. How obvious is the hypocrisy?
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Actually, it's very obvious. First of all, because the Americans are looking for democracy in the Middle East. That was very clearly stated by Donald Trump before Biden. Secondly, we saw how the Biden administration treated Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, saying they're not after him, but they want to sanction only element that he has ordered. Therefore, there is no human rights here to talk about. And it's completely hypocrisy manifested in every single way. We see in Yemen when the Americans are asking the Yemeni to stop advancing toward Maghreb, but they're not lifting the sanctions. We see the U.S. occupying Syria and preventing the commerce to return between Iraq and Syria, and that's also another form of hypocrisy. We see the sanctions on Iran, the sanctions on Venezuela. All the U.S. acts are double standards, and we are used to that. So therefore, it is just the fact that we listen to the U.S. administration, just cherry-picking whatever they want, whatever they select to say this is human rights violation, or this is not human rights violation, or that we cannot sanction, or yes, we can sanction the entire population. Mm. And this game is very obvious today. It is no longer possible to cheat the population and the world who is watching how the U.S. is behaving.
Okay. Now, Daniel Irwan's leader has slammed the U.S. for creating military bases in West Asia under the pretext of fighting terrorists. You know, it's a known fact that the U.S. gave rise to terrorists like Daesh, as admitted by American officials. So what is it that Washington pursues by spending big bucks and setting up numerous military bases around the world while facing a plethora of issues back home?
Yeah, I think this question can be answered through a mixture of imperialism, dominance, coercion, and also finding ways of population control and containment, which is what the United States has effectively been doing in the region for decades. And of course, there is oil and money and capitalist interests that play a role, as well as, of course, the U.S. weapons industry that has a great market in Western Asia, which effectively also politically translates into an extraterritorial expansion of U.S. Sovereignty that is perpetuated through these expansion of military bases. And what I think Mike Pompeo at one point has called the U.S. or the American experiment. I think also the term terrorist, as you mentioned, happens to be void of meaning and can be reinterpreted in political discourse in many different ways that suit the particular political interest of the United States in order to create consent for containing or opposing any sort of enemy or opposition they might encounter in Western Asia.
Exactly. Good terrorists, bad terrorists, and all that. Okay, Elijah, Ayatollah Khamenei also touched upon Washington's claims of human rights and then advocating violators of human rights. He cited the murder of the Saudi dissident journalist, and you mentioned that, also the war in Yemen. In one case, Washington failed to punish the perpetrator despite evidence its own intelligence apparatus has acquired. And in the other one, it keeps selling lethal weapons to the invader to claim more innocent lives. Your take on that.
Washington doesn't want to punish anybody that is considered as an ally. What the Americans are about is protect itself from losing ground and losing its hegemony in the Middle East. This is why the Americans behave in such a way. From their point of view, they think they are defending their interest and their national security, whatever it needs to do so, they're going to do it. All these flashy titles means nothing. The Americans are in the region because they are losing ground and because they see particularly Russia winning in Syria, Iran winning in Syria, the Syrian government is regaining control. So they think they, by saying the violation of human rights in Syria by President Assad, so we impose sanction on Assad. In fact, they're not doing it. They start with the population in Syria, Yemen, Iran, Venezuela, everywhere. That is not a human right. So whatever they are saying today, we don't take it with a pinch of salt. We just don't believe it because they can't anymore repeat the same mantra and the same narrative because we know the Americans are agonizing in the Middle East because they are losing ground. They're still very powerful, but they're no longer in control. They are losing ground in Iraq, and we see the Iraqis are demanding they leave and they abandon the country and they are resisting. So all that is a manifestation of the U.S. by bringing out excuses to remain in the Middle East and find reasons to remain in the Middle East. But it's not going to last for very long.
Now, my next question is for Daniel. Iran has also rejected the U.S. claim that the Islamic Republic's regional presence is destabilizing. The country is saying that Iran's regional presence is non-military and also requested by those countries, contrary to the U.S. presence there. Who's playing a destabilizing role in this part of the world?
And it's further like rhetoric on Iran's regional presence is quite interesting because Iran is eventually part of this region, and its presence in this region is natural. The people of Iran are indigenous to this region, unlike the U.S. military forces, which were stationed across Iran's borders and the region. So question of who is a destabilizing force also goes back to what intention which factor has in this case. And the United States, as we've seen, has been supporting several non-democratic regimes in the region through direct efforts, but has also attempted to destabilize Iran through sanctions, through economic warfare, as well as through supporting extremist factors in the region, with Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime just being two examples of regimes that are having a destabilizing role in the region that are directly and indirectly funded and supported by the United States and its allies. And also here, I guess, again, military weapons and oil play a major role that perpetuates this idea of the United States that is obscuring rhetorically the destabilizing force it has in the region, at the same time, in a certain way, presenting it through a discourse on human rights and protesting and liberation and all of these things that have been coming out in the last years and decades.
Now, Elijah, in another part of his speech, Iran's leader reminds the fact that the U.S. is the only country that has used A-bombs and claimed 220,000 lives in Japan. Yet it claims to oppose the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Is this anything but duplicity?
Well, it is historical that the U.S. used a nuclear bomb against Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the Japanese were surrendering. And it is not only that. The U.S. is supporting Israel in its construction of bombs. It has a couple of hundreds of nuclear bombs in the Middle East and is protecting this information and is protecting Israel and is accepting that Israel has bombs that are nuclear bombs and preventing any other country in the Middle East from creating a balance or preventing Israel from being the only one that can use the bomb, because Israel said it in 1973 it was about to use also its atomic bomb against the Middle Eastern country. So the Americans are actually not accusing Iran of having a nuclear bomb. They know Iran is against having a nuclear bomb. They just want to curb Iranian will, and they want to force Iran to come to the nuclear, to the discussion table. And what they are doing is they saying only us as the world policemen, we can have the nuclear bomb in the Middle East, and we can say who can have what and who cannot have it. And if we remember Iran during the Shah time, it was the Americans who brought the nuclear atomic energy program to Iran, because the Shah was a friend of Iran, a friend of the US. Therefore, it's only selective countries, depending how friendly they are with the US, can be allowed to have what the US allowed them to have.
Exactly, as they are now helping the Saudis have that. Now, Danielle, Foreign Minister Zarif has also criticized the Biden administration for following in Trump's footsteps. And one instance is Washington's opposing the unfreezing of Iranian money in South Korea. Your comment on that point?
Yeah, I think this is a good example of the lack of difference between the Biden and the Trump administrations when it comes to Iran, as well as what has just been mentioned, the Israeli nuclear program, which is another example of, and that shows that the U.S. involvement in this area is structural rather than related to individual incidents. The United States is, of course, keen on keeping its power in place by when it comes to Israel, facilitating its nuclear program, at the same time obscuring it and preventing Israel from accountability and punity. The issue with the Iranian money in South Korea is another one where the Biden administration might have initially had maybe different words, but they are results of the same rhetoric, of the same structure that effectively, again, expands the U.S. Imperialist discourse on Iran, in which it is the United States that seeks to set the any sort of agreement and has the final word and has to set conditions in order to effectively also prove that it is involved in this issue. It has sort of, again, as I mentioned before, this extraterritorial sovereignty that it actually does not have in the region.
Now, Elijah, there are many observers who argue that the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran has proved to be a failure. So what's behind the new administration's not coming to terms with this fact?
That's a very good question. Actually, what we have seen from the new Biden administration is a president that is extremely confused and hesitant. And we see that not only the Biden administration is using Trump's sanctions, harsh sanctions on Iran, but all the administrations, starting from Jimmy Carter until today, since 1979, the U.S. imposed sanctions after sanctions against Iran. And that was a blessing to Iran because it forced Iran to be self-sufficient and it forced Iran to rely only on itself. However, yes, the harsh sanction prevented Iran from having hundreds of billions of dollars from the oil revenue, but it's created another positive aspect. Now, yes, the sanctions are a failure, but Biden doesn't want to look weak because he's already confused. He wants Iran to come to the table, and then he wants a simultaneous lift of sanction and compliance. It doesn't work because the Americans pulled out, and Iran is on its position, saying, you lift all the sanctions, and we return to the JCPOA. If this is not going to happen, Iran is going to continue escalating by using its right to abandon the JCPOA slowly but surely. And Biden can keep himself and then hold on to his sanctions, increase them, or just keep them as he wants, and he's not going to get anywhere. He needs Iran for the stability in the Middle East, even if the stability in the Middle East is not on the table. But the JCPOA will be the beginning of a talk between Iran and the Americans, and that will spare the Americans many lives, because the allies of Iran are not going to leave the Americans alone. And if Biden administration is looking, that is walking on the step of Trump administration, the Americans will not only leave the Middle East, but they will leave extremely high number of casualties behind.
Okay. Daniel, same question for you, because we have only 1 minute and so left. Will the U.S. change course and learn from past mistakes?
I don't think that this is likely at this point, because that would necessitate a change of discourse, direction of the discourse that's currently happening, and it would necessitate, first of all, recognition that the United States has been responsible for causing a lot of hardship to Iran in the past decades, which I think is very unlikely. And effectively, as we've seen, I mean, the Biden administration is not very different from the Trump administration, especially when it comes to Iran. Biden's electoral campaign was largely based on him portraying himself as not being Trump, but effectively the U.S. policy, any shift in its discourse on Iran, a radical one that would be needed in order to recognize these many mistakes that have been done, would at the same time destabilize the foundations of U.S. foreign policy that also is, in at least Western Asia, is very much tied to the U.S. political identity.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Thank you, my guests. We had journalist and political analyst Elijah Magner from Brussels, an author, and researcher Daniel Jegic from Beirut. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
President Joe Biden held one more giant step forward on delivering on that promise that help is on the way. after Democrats took a critical step towards a first major legislative victory since assuming control of Congress and the White House, with a party-line vote in the Senate to approve a $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalists Lauren Gambino and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Biden Hails Giant Step as Senate Passes $1.9 Trillion Coronavirus Relief Bill. Stay with us for more of Lauren Gambino and Martin Pengelly's article. President Joe Biden held one more giant step forward on delivering on that promise that help is on the way, after Democrats took a critical step towards the first major legislative victory since assuming control of Congress and the White House, with a party-line vote in the Senate to approve a $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill. After a marathon voting session through the night on Friday and into Saturday afternoon, 6th of March, Democrats overcame unified Republican opposition to approve the sweeping stimulus package. The final tally was 50 votes in favor, 49 votes against, with one Republican senator absent. One of the largest emergency aid packages in U.S. history now returns to the House of Representatives for final approval before being signed into law by President Biden. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, has said she expects to approve the measure before 14th of March, when tens of millions of Americans risk losing unemployment benefits if no action is taken. The House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, said the Senate version of the American Rescue Plan would be considered on Tuesday so that we can send this bill to President Biden for his signature early next week. Biden and Democrats will look to move on to other priorities, including voting rights reform and an ambitious infrastructure package. The bill aimed at combating the COVID-19 pandemic and reviving the U.S. economy will provide direct payments of up to $1,400 to most Americans, extend federal unemployment benefits, rush money to state, local, and tribal governments, and allot significant funding to vaccine distribution and testing. Republicans attacked the bill as a liberal wish list, mismatched with an improving economic and public health outlook as more are vaccinated and infections plateau. Our country is already set for a roaring recovery, said Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, on Friday, 5th of March, citing a jobs report that showed 379,000 jobs added in February. Democrats inherited a tide that was already turning, Mitch McConnell said. But Democrats and the White House were quick to push back, pointing to more than 9 million Americans out of work and millions more struggling to pay their rent and for their food. On Saturday, 6th of March, with Vice President Kamala Harris looking on, President Biden spoke to reporters at the White House. I want to thank all of the senators who worked so hard to do the right thing for the American people during this crisis and voting to pass the American Rescue Plan, he said. It obviously wasn't easy, wasn't always pretty, but it was so desperately needed, urgently needed. Biden has been criticized for not holding a press conference since taking office. On Saturday, he attempted to leave without taking questions. To shout at questions, he avoided direct criticism of Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia or Republicans. The marathon Votorama session on amendments that preceded the final vote featured the longest vote in Senate history, just shy of 12 hours, on Friday, 5th of March, as Democrats scrambled to strike a deal with Senator Joe Manchin, a moderate who mounted a last-minute push to scale back unemployment benefits. Bowing to Senator Manchin, a compromise kept benefits at $300 a week instead of $400, as proposed by President Biden and approved by the House. However, the benefits will be extended until October rather than August, and Democrats added a provision to provide up to $10,200 in tax relief for unemployed Americans. Speaking to reporters on Saturday, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer repeatedly held his caucus and deflected invitations to criticize Senator Joe Manchin, the target of anger among House progressives. "People have new differences all the time," he said, when asked why Senator Manchin had not leveled his demand earlier. Chuck Schumer added, "Unity, unity, unity. That's how we got this done." Schumer was asked if another bill might be needed. "It's a very strong bill," he said. "Part of it will depend on COVID. How long will it last? Will there be a new strain?" Experts have warned of a potential fourth surge as variants emerge and predominantly Republican states reopen their economies and abandon basic public health measures. Senator Chuck Schumer added, "Part of it will depend on the economy. It has some underlying weaknesses that need bolstering. How deep and weak are those? Our number one lodestar is going to be helping the American people, and if they need more help, we'll do another bill. If this bill is sufficient, and I think it's going to help in a big way, then we won't." At the White House, President Biden praised Chuck Schumer. "When the country needed you most, you led, Chuck, and you delivered." Despite deep political polarization and staunch Republican opposition, the legislation has broad public appeal. An opinion poll by Monmouth University found that 62% of the American public approve of the stimulus package, including more than 3 in 10 Republicans. In tweets on Saturday, former President Barack Obama said, "Elections matter. This is the kind of progress that's possible when we elect leaders across government who are devoted to making people's lives better." Yet the endeavor tested the fragile alliance between progressives and moderates as Democrats attempt to wield their power with only the barest control of Congress. Early on Friday, the Senate rejected a proposal by the Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders to include a $15 an hour minimum wage increase, a top liberal priority and a key plank of Joe Biden's economic agenda. The Senate parliamentarian had deemed the provision inadmissible under the rules of a special budget process Democrats are using to bypass Republican opposition. Despite widespread public support for raising the federal minimum wage, Democrats remained divided. On Friday, 5th of March, 8 joined Republicans in blocking the amendment, which would have required 60 votes to pass. "Let me be very clear, we're not giving up on this," Bernie Sanders said. "We're going to come back with vote after vote, and one way or the other, we're going to pass a $15 minimum wage. That is what the American people want, and that is what the American people need." The approval of the bill in the Senate came after hours upon hours of voting on a torrent of amendments, most offered by Republicans with the goal of forcing Democrats to take a position on measures designed to be politically troublesome. Proceedings had already been much delayed on Thursday when the Republican Ron Johnson of Wisconsin forced Senate clerks to read the 628-page bill in its entirety, a task that took nearly 11 hours. At the White House, Joe Biden quoted Bernie Sanders as he hailed the bill as progressive and delivered a familiar appeal for national and party unity, if with a shot at his predecessor, Donald Trump. "When I was elected," Biden said, "I said we're going to get the government out of the business of battling on Twitter and back in the business of delivering for the American people, of making a difference in their lives, giving everyone a fighting chance, of showing the American people that the government can work for them, and passing the American Rescue Plan. We'll do that." You know, it may sound strange, but I really want to thank the American people. Quite frankly, without the overwhelming bipartisan support of the American people, this would not have happened.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.